welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This is the third of three consecutive shows with different guests on The Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. In the first 2 weeks, we discussed Out of the Silent Planet with David Whalen and Perelandro with Monica Hilder. Today, our guest is Michael Ward, a Catholic priest. He's based at the University of Oxford, where he's a member of the Faculty of Theology and Religion and professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University. He's the author of Planet Narnia and the presenter of the BBC television documentary, The Narnia Code. His latest book is After Humanity, a guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. He's podcasted with us previously on The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis, and he joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Michael, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be with you.
Why is That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis a great book?
Because it is, first and foremost, the culmination, the conclusion of this trilogy, which is itself a series of very interesting and valuable books. And That Hideous Strength is the capstone. In a way, That Hideous Strength is what the whole trilogy has been driving to. The first book is set on Mars, a very masculine planet. Second book is set on Venus, the feminine planet. And the first word, the opening word of That Hideous Strength, is the word matrimony. In other words, marriage. This is where masculinity and femininity come together. This is where the whole trilogy has been driving to. How do Mark and Jane, the protagonists of this novel, live into their masculinity and femininity respectively, which have been laid out in the previous two books, and how do they save their unhappy marriage? That's really what the novel is principally about, I think.
We're going to talk about all that, the characters, the story, the climax of the entire trilogy, and so forth. But I'd like to start with a question about the movies, rather than about this book, because last year saw the release of a movie about C.S. Lewis called A Most Reluctant Convert. What's it about, and what part did you play in it?
That movie is about Lewis's conversion, first of all to theism and then to Christianity, the story that he basically tells in his own autobiography, Surprised by Joy. It originated as a stage play starring Max MacLean, a one-man stage play, and now it's been turned into a proper film with a larger cast, indeed three actors playing C.S. Lewis himself at various stages of his life. And I play Lewis's parish priest, his Anglican vicar in Oxford. I'm in two scenes, I have lines, and it was a great fun thing to do, because I myself used to be an Anglican priest. I'm now a Catholic priest, and indeed they let me bring some of my own Catholic vestments to wear, so I helped out the costume department. And I've seen the film now several times, and it's very well worth watching. You can, I think, stream it live from cslewismovie.com.
I've not seen the film, but I've seen the stage play with Max MacLean, and it is excellent, so I recommend that. Okay, enough about movies and plays. Let's talk about this book, That Hideous Strength. It's related to another book by C.S. Lewis. That Hideous Strength, of course, is a novel, but there's another book written by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man, published in 1943, which is show number 117 in this podcast series with you, Michael Ward, as the guest. But in the preface to That Hideous Strength, before we dive into the story or anything, C.S. Lewis writes this, quote, "This is a tall story about devilry, though it has behind it a serious point, which I have tried to make in my Abolition of Man," unquote. So what's his point, and why has he turned to fiction to make it?
Lewis loved trying things out in two different modes, what he would have called the contemplative mode and the enjoyment mode. Contemplative mode means the abstract mode, the external, analytical, impersonal approach to a subject, just dissecting it and talking about it in a sort of propositional way. But the enjoyment mode is involved, it's personal, it's committed, it's dramatic, and You see this all over Lewis's works, actually. You know, The Problem of Pain discusses suffering from a contemplative standpoint, all intellectual and argumentative, whereas A Grief Observed, about the bereavement he suffered after his wife's death, is very personal, very emotional, very subjective. Quite a lot of Lewis's works can be paired up in that way, and so with The Abolition of Man and That Hideous Strength. That Hideous Strength puts into dramatic form many of the ideas that Lewis discusses in The Abolition of Man. There are lots and lots of points of contact and overlap between the two books. But it's interesting how highly Lewis thought of both books. He said of The Abolition of Man, it's almost my favourite among my books. And when asked which of the trilogy was his own favourite, he said That Hideous Strength. He said Perelander was the best of the trilogy, but he said That Hideous Strength was his favourite.
In the opening scene of That Hideous Strength, we meet Jane Studdock, this protagonist. You've already mentioned her. She has marriage on her mind. Who is she and why is she thinking about marriage?
Well, she is already married. It's on her mind because she's unhappy. She only got married a few months ago, and already she's getting a bit cheesed off by the whole experience, largely because her husband, Mark, is increasingly away at work and getting more and more sucked into his work responsibilities and neglecting her. And she's got this tiny little flat, which she can easily, you know, keep control of, and she's supposed to be doing a doctorate. She's a student studying the works of John Donne, the poet. But she's not very happy in that either. And interestingly, Mark and Jane have decided not to have children. So their marriage is contracepted. Contraception, interestingly, is a topic that Lewis discusses in The Abolition of Man. It's part and parcel of this theme of gender that Mark and Jane are denying their fertility. He's not truly masculine, she's not truly feminine. They've decided to prevent that aspect of their natures from being expressed. And that stultification of their true nature as man and woman respectively is a sort of dramatic expression of some of these ideas about the control of nature, or rather the manipulation of nature, that Lewis discusses academically in The Abolition of Man.
So Jane and Mark are in this struggling marriage. Tell us a little bit more about Mark. Who is he, the husband, in this partnership?
Yeah, he's a young academic. He's a bit of a callow young man who wants to impress people, and that's why he increasingly spends time at work, because he's trying to climb the greasy pole. He's trying to enter the inner ring of the influential people in his institution. He doesn't really know himself. He wants to be thought highly of. He wants to strike poses and be admired by his wife and his colleagues. But he has no true stable center to him as a man. And the whole of the story is a sort of split narrative between Mark's trajectory and Jane's. You keep lurching back and forth between their individual storylines, and only a couple of three times in the whole of the novel do you see them together. And that's part of, you know, the structure of the whole story about, you know, marriage is supposed to be the coming together of a husband and wife, and you hardly ever see them together until the end, which is the great resolution of the entire story, and I better not spoil that.
The first two books, as you say, take place mostly on Mars, which is a kind of masculine planet, and Venus, a feminine planet. This one is set on Earth. We're also in something called the Space Trilogy. That doesn't sound very science fiction-y, a story on Earth. I suppose it could be. But why are we there, and what does this title mean, the Space Trilogy?
Yeah, well, I think that it's best to call the trilogy the Ransom Trilogy. Ransom being the hero, Elwyn Ransom, who is in all three books. If you don't want to call it the Ransom Trilogy, some people call it the Cosmic Trilogy. But I think it's definitely wrong to call it the Space Trilogy. As far as I'm aware, Lewis never called it that. And I'm sure he wouldn't have done, because the whole point, especially in the first book, Out of the Silent Planet, is to show that space is the wrong word. He actually uses that phrase. Space is the wrong word. Older thinkers had been wiser when they called space the heavens. Space, we're told, is a blasphemous libel for the Empyrean ocean of radiance, which is up there in the celestial fields. And at the end of that first book, we're told that if Lewis and Ransom, the characters within the story, could effect a changeover of just 10% of their readers from using the word space to using the word heavens, they would have made a start. Now, it's never going to be called the Heavens Trilogy, but that would be much better than calling it the Space Trilogy.
The subtitle of That Hideous Strength is A Modern Fairy Tale for Grown-Ups, which is a peculiar subtitle, I think. What do you make of it? What do you think that means? And again, it doesn't sound very science fiction-y.
It's interesting what Lewis says in the preface. I have called this a fairy tale in the hope that no one who dislikes fantasy may be misled by the first two chapters into reading further and then complain of his disappointment. If you ask why, intending to write about magicians, devils, pantomime animals, and planetary angels, I nevertheless begin with such humdrum scenes and persons, he means the domestic arrangements of Jane and the educational arrangements of Mark. If you ask why I nevertheless begin with such humdrum scenes and persons, I reply that I'm following the traditional fairy tale. We don't always notice its method, because the cottages, castles, woodcutters, and petty kings with which a fairy tale opens have become for us as remote as the witches and ogres to which it proceeds. But they were not remote at all to the men who made and first enjoyed the stories. And then he goes on to say how, you know, from those early humdrum scenes, the story is going to advance into a realm of magic and dystopia and all sorts of extraordinary things that crash into this quiet little world of Mark and Jane, including planetary angels. So it's not just Mars and Venus who exert their influence over this story. Three other planets shed their influence down upon the Earth, namely Mercury and Jupiter and Saturn. And Lewis, of course, being a medieval scholar, knew all about how in the medieval model of the cosmos, the planets were held to have these various attributes and characteristics and influences that they would shed upon the Earth. The principal ones, as we've been saying, are the martial and the venereal influences, but some of the other planets also get a look in.
That sounds so superstitious and astrological. Why do we have these influences in a 20th century, ostensibly science fiction novel?
Yeah, well, Lewis was a medievalist. That was his professional line of work, teaching at Oxford and ending up as the first professor of medieval and Renaissance English at Cambridge. And he had a particular interest in the heavens, as they were understood in medieval times. And he described the seven planets as spiritual symbols of permanent value, which were especially worthwhile in his own generation. Of Saturn, we know more than enough, he said, but who does not need to be reminded of Jove, of Jupiter? And so he writes a great deal about the planets in his academic works, in his book The Discarded Image, for instance. He wrote a long, complicated poem called The Planets, in which he gave a poetic expression to these different influences. And here in the trilogy, the whole structure of the trilogy is based on Mars, Venus, and then matrimony, where the two masculine and feminine principles come together.
So we have this struggling marriage in the middle of this large and complicated and inspiring solar system with its planets and their influences and so on. And into this situation, we learn about something called NICE, N-I-C-E, the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, which sounds like a creepy think tank in a James Bond movie or something. What is NICE? How does it enter the story, and what does it all mean?
Golly, that is a hard question to answer. That Hideous Strength is a long novel. It's longer than the first two books put together, and there's a lot going on in the story. The NICE is this organization, this villainous organization, that are set to basically overtake England. They're a quasi-scientific bureaucracy, but really they're just a front for a demonic invasion of England. These scientists and bureaucrats and the rest of them, these educationalists, they don't really realize what they're letting in with their nature-denying moves of various kinds. And the peril that Mark and Jane are in is that they too, in denying their own nature as man and woman, respectively, are, you know, perilously on the brink of being sucked into this organization. And are they going to be able to struggle free or not?
So we have Mark and Jane. We have Nice. And then we meet our old friend Elwin Ransom, the hero from the first two books. He's kind of a supporting character in That Hideous Strength. How does he come into the story? What is his role?
Yeah, this is one of the oddities about That Hideous Strength, that although Ransom has been very obviously the protagonist in the first two books, in this third book, he plays, relatively speaking, a minor role. Mark and Jane, as we've said, are the protagonists, and then there's these villains who get quite a good look in too. Ransom is confined to, you know, almost the status of a bit part player. I mean, he is important. He's sort of logically important in that it's he who effectively brings together Mark and Jane. He's the human cause of that. He's the priest who marries them, or, you know, who heals their marriage. But he's relatively minor, and this again is one of the reasons why people find the trilogy a bit confusing, because it seems to have veered off track after the first two books set on these distant planets. Now we're back on Earth. We've got this different cast, and Elwin seems to have sunk out of focus. But the way to understand the trilogy as a whole, as I say, is about gender. If you keep that as the interpretative key, masculinity, femininity, marriage, then the trilogy begins to cohere a bit better and make better sense.
We don't have time to go into all the other characters, but there are so many to at least reference and name check. Merlin makes an appearance. Merlin from the King Arthur stories. We meet something called the Head, who is this weird and funny and almost comic figure, I want to say, in certain ways. The Macrobes and so on. Just give us a taste of what else is in this book, this panoply of characters.
Yeah, it's almost easier to say what's not in the book, because it's so various and vibrant and colorful. Lewis, in one or two letters that he wrote about this time when he was bringing the novel to completion, said that he wondered at times whether it wasn't all bosh and rubbish, and that he felt it had almost slipped the leash and he sort of lost control of it as a novel. But eventually he, you know, finished it, published it, and as I said, later regarded it as his favourite of the three. And I'm very much of the same opinion. I think That Hideous Strength is a fantastically good novel. It's got all these things going on, and they almost seem to be, you know, escaping from authorial control. But that just gives the book its vitality and almost its sense of danger. You think the author can't hold the circle, but he just manages to. It's got a great sense of urgency, and it's sort of too much. It's over the top, but in a good way. And that's why it's so enjoyable to go back to it, because it's just like a massive banquet with every conceivable food and drink. And yeah, you feel just a little bit stuffed, maybe overstuffed at the end, but it was a great ride.
Michael, this third book in the trilogy, That Hideous Strength, often described as a dystopian novel, this book, written in 1945, comes between two of the great classic dystopian novels of the 20th century, and I mean Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, 1984 by George Orwell. Is it dystopian? Does it fit into that tradition? How should we think of it in the context of these other works?
Yeah, George Orwell, interestingly, reviewed That Hideous Strength and didn't like it very much. He thought that it didn't succeed in staying on one level.
He did say go ahead and read it, didn't he? He encouraged his readers to check it out.
Yeah, no, he didn't diss it completely, but he said that it would have been better if Mr. Lewis had kept the story on one level, because he disliked the breaking in of the supernatural, you know, these planetary angels and the macrobes, these demonic spirits. And of course, if you go to 1984, That's very much a this-worldly novel about politics and bureaucracy and government, and you know, questions of the supernatural, or let alone the preternatural, don't get a look in. But Lewis's whole point as a Christian is that life in this world is more than merely materialistic. There is the spiritual realm, there is the moral realm, there is indeed the preternatural realm, the sort of the realm sort of halfway between the human mundane world and the absolutely supernatural realm of God, the uncreated realm. So that's one of the reasons why Orwell didn't like it. But I love it. This is one of the reasons why it's so colourful and various, that everything gets a look in. But how is it dystopian? Well, because effectively, Lewis is saying, George Orwell's dystopian vision is too limited, it's too narrow, as if the only things that could go wrong in the future relate to politics and bureaucracy and government and education and science. Well, those things can all go astray, yeah, but behind them is the moral realm, the spiritual realm, the realm of angels and demons, and behind them, the Creator himself. So Lewis's vision is far more complex and, from my Christian point of view, far more realistic. The novel's title, That Hideous Strength, is an allusion to a 16th century poem about the Tower of Babel. Remember the Tower of Babel story from the book of Genesis, about how these men built a tower to the heavens in the hope that they would make a name for themselves, and effectively make themselves God. You know, they would reach up to the heavens themselves in this massive superstructure. And in this 16th century poem by Sir David Lindsay, we have these lines: "The shadow of that hideous strength, 6 mile and more it is of length." So think of a skyscraper with a shadow stretching out for 6 miles. That's how tall the Tower of Babel was, according to David Lindsay. And that's that superstructure, that attempts of man to become God, is what the nice are attempting.
How is this work Christian? We've been talking about the astrological influences of the planets, these strange angelic and spiritual figures who are not in the Bible, as far as I know. Lewis, of course, was a great Christian apologist, but how is that hideous strength Christian?
Well, astrology is not necessarily unchristian. It can be. You know, if you end up worshipping the planets, that would be unchristian. If you ended up believing that the planets have such influence over human affairs that human beings are no longer responsible but are totally determined in their operations, that would be unchristian. But there's a long tradition of Christian astrology in the Bible and in history. I mean, look at the book of Judges in the Old Testament, where we're told that the stars in their courses were fighting against Sisera. There we get an indication that actually there do seem to be some sort of effects or influences that the heavenly bodies can exert over human affairs. Psalm 19, the heavens are telling the glory of God, the firmament proclaims his handiwork. There the celestial bodies are regarded as effectively angels, messengers of God's glory. Think of Matthew's gospel and the wise men, the magi coming from the east. We have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. They are probably Babylonian astrologers, and yet their astrology leads them to the birthplace of Jesus Christ, and they go in and worship him, bringing gold and frankincense and myrrh before him. And there are various other examples too. If you look closely in the Bible, you see that the stars are not just, you know, large balls of rock and gas floating above our heads. They're much more significant than that. Now, Lewis, when he's plugging into this long tradition of Christian astrology, is obviously miles away, light years away from those stupid horoscopes that you see in the back pages of magazines. You're born under Gemini, and this Tuesday you're going to meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger. I mean, that's not what he's talking about at all. He's just trying to imbue the universe, or remember that the universe is imbued with spiritual significance. It's not just matter and motion.
This sounds similar to what he does in the Chronicles of Narnia, which come in the next decade. He finishes the Space Trilogy or the Ransom Trilogy in the 1940s. In the next decade, we get the Chronicles of Narnia, another kind of Christian story, but told in a disguised fashion.
Yeah, well, I've got a whole book about this.
I know you do. It's called Planet Narnia. It's an excellent book. Give us the 1 minute elevator pitch about Planet Narnia.
Well, there are seven Chronicles of Narnia, and there are seven medieval planets, and that's not a coincidence, in my view. Lewis took these planetary symbols, these spiritual symbols of permanent value, as he called them, which he'd invested so much time and energy in studying and writing about over the decades. And in the Narnia Chronicles, he structures each chronicle out of the relevant imagery pertaining unto one of these seven planets. So that the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for instance, is his Jupiter story. It's a jovial story. Prince Caspian is martial. It's full of fighting and woods. The Dawn Treader is the solar story, full of gold and sunlight, and so on and so forth, seven times over. And there, interestingly, Aslan, the Christ character, sums up in his own person the various attributes that the medieval astrologers associated with these seven heavens, and very thoroughly and completely it's Christianized, it's baptized. In That Hideous Strength, Lewis talks about baptizing the influences of Venus. Mother Dimble, this maternal character who's a sort of mother figure to Jane Studdock, she has baptized Venus's influence, whereas Jane Studdock herself has not yet. She needs to learn how to do that. So this, I hope, will reassure people who think, when they hear the word astrology, they immediately think pagan, occult, dangerous. There are much more wholesome and healthy ways of approaching it, and Lewis is certainly trying to achieve that.
Tell us briefly how That Hideous Strength finishes. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Jane and Mark come together at the end. What is the significance of that? Why does he end the whole trilogy on this note, the salvation of this marriage?
Well, it's not just Mark and Jane who come together either. It's all the married couples come together in one way or another. And indeed, all the animals come together and pair off, the elephants and the mice and the bats and the hedgehogs even. All these pairs go off, you know, it's like, go be fruitful and multiply. And I think that's because gender, masculinity and femininity are revealed to us at their maximum in the act of generation. New life only comes about from the coming together of masculinity and femininity. That's the only way that life can go on. And so it's in the sexual act, it's in the act of procreation, that masculinity and femininity show themselves at the maximum. That's what Mark and Jane have been trying to deny for so much of the story. But eventually they relax into their genders, respectively, their sexuality, respectively. And as a result, new life can come from their loving, open-hearted embrace of each other.
Final question as we wrap up, maybe a two-part question. Michael, how did you discover C.S. Lewis as a reader and then also the Space Trilogy? And finally, what's the case for reading the Space Trilogy now in a different century?
Well, I first got into Lewis in the way that many people do, I suppose. I had the Narnia books read to me by my parents when I was a young boy, and I then went and read them for myself when I was a bit older, and gradually worked my way through the whole of Lewis's fictional output and his Christian apologetics. I did a degree in English at Oxford and then began studying Lewis's more academic writings. Ended up doing my PhD on him, too. So he's followed me, or I've followed him, the whole of my life, pretty much. I remember when I first read the Ransom Trilogy that I enjoyed it, but I was a bit mystified by it. And it took two or three reads for me to begin to perceive all this gender imagery and how that is the superstructure. And when you approach it from that point of view, it begins to make very good sense, and very provocative and prophetic sense, too. So I think one of the reasons why Lewis was so interested in this question of gender is that in 1930, the Church of England, Lewis was an Anglican, the Church of England relaxed its teaching on contraception and said, under certain circumstances, contraception's okay. But until that point, the Anglican Church, and indeed all Protestant churches, had maintained the traditional opposition to contraception. And Lewis had such a logical mind that he saw where this might well lead, that if we deny our masculinity and femininity in marriage, what else might we deny next? What other part of our nature might we begin to suppress or manipulate or change to suit our convenience? And the result of that logical progression, you know, just seeing where A leads to B, to C, this inevitable chain of logic, the result of all that for Lewis was, principally, the abolition of man from a contemplative point of view and the Ransom Trilogy from an enjoyment point of view. And now in the 21st century, where the transgender movement and the attempt to revise understanding of marriage have reached new heights or new depths, depending on how you want to talk about it, just, I think, is a testimony to Lewis's insight. He saw where it was all leading, and we are now seeing where it has led.
Michael Ward, thanks for joining us and telling us all about That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis.
My pleasure. Thanks, John.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last fall, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.